and welcome to the Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Alex Lacey, and this, I don't know the whole thing on my own.
I'm not Emily Dell.
No, you're not Emily Dell, are you? I've forgotten the whole thing. I was like, I'll do the whole intro and I can't remember it. We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a lot of information, a lot of laughs. Help me out, Fiona, and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found
on Instagram at Ladies Who London Podcast and on our websites, guideemily.com, which is having a rebrand at the minute, and alexlacey.com for more information about us and the podcast. And as you can probably hear today, we don't have Emily with us. We have the lovely Fiona back. Hi, Fiona.
Hello. It is lovely to be back.
Thank you so much for jumping in very last minute. Fiona is amazing because just to update you, Emily's daughter has been a little bit ill, so they've been in the hospital. She's out now, but Emily's obviously very much otherwise engaged. So Fiona has come in to save the day and be our guest for today. So how are you, Fiona?
I'm good. Surprisingly busy still this time of year, which is nice, but yeah, you know.
It's really weird. And I think we were just saying as we were kind of prepping with it's I kind of miss my November off. Normally November is I take November
kind
off
winding down,
and I'm still going at a million miles an hour. It's bonkers, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And I'm doing tomorrow night a virtual tour, which I've done one recently, but not many for a while since then, and they're going out to America. So we're doing them at 10:30 at night, which is a little bit weird.
Bit of a shock. I remember in the peak of the pandemic when I was doing some virtual tours and for America, and they were at like 12:30 at night or 1 a.m. and
it's weird.
It's a bit weird. Then you sort of stagger to bed and then it's a bit of a shock. But interesting to know that virtual tours are still happening.
There's a few sort of agencies that are still doing quite a few.
Yeah,
ones who've really kind of taken to it.
Yeah. I'm still doing the very occasional one, very, very occasional, mostly for school kids in France. But it's definitely a new sort of string to our bow, isn't it, doing that?
Yeah. And this is one I have done a few times before. It's about Tudor London. And I went back to look through it, and it was reassuringly familiar.
Oh, good.
Because sometimes you look at the slides you've got and you go, why did I put that slide in? But this it all makes sense.
You know what it all means. That's good. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for stepping in this week. Now, originally we were planning to have a whole podcast on Simpsons, the restaurant we thought it was the restaurant that was closing down. We got our Simpsons mixed up. So the restaurant that's closing down is Simpsons in the City, which is the oldest chop house in the city. And we thought it was Simpsons in the Strand that was closing down. So Emily will do that next week. It'll be not the one we thought it was, but we will extend it to be
a Simpsons.
A Simpsons. You'll get a Simpsons and it'll be a restaurant. So we're gonna chat about them, and we'll kind of fill you in on the Simpsons in the City one, which is the one that's closing down as well, and how you can help on that one. So I thought, because it was all been a bit last minute getting everything sorted, I thought I'd bring one out from the archive, which is one that if you ever watched Global Tea Break back in the height of the pandemic over on Instagram, this was one of my favourite ones that we ever did, which is, because we haven't spun the wheel, we haven't linked it to anywhere, it was quite a good one to haul out of the archive because it's really fun, and it's a bit odd, and it's all about the weirdest jobs that people have had throughout history. And you love a weird thing, don't you, Fiona? I'm a big fan of the weird things.
and the bizarre and randomly weird. Yes, I'm in for this.
and what's great is that Fiona is always the person, whenever I think I bet there's a really weird story or a bit of random factoid that would go with this, Fiona is the person I go to, because she's one of the most, you're such an observant person that you observe shadows and like the one duck that's doing something weird, like you are that kind of person. And so I love, you know, bringing all these things out for you, because I know that you'll be popping in with bits of, well, actually, did you know, ..
yeah. Good. No pressure then.
No pressure. So essentially, this is going to be a list of some of the weirdest jobs that have happened throughout history. And if you watch any of the programmes that you get on the telly all about different periods of history, some of these might be familiar to you because they are properly bonkers and people love to pick up on them because they really are, aren't they? There's some properly mad stuff. And I'm going to go in for The place that a lot of people love to go in, especially if you are visiting places, castles and palaces with kids. What do kids love?
Well, I mean, lots of things they love, but because I think I know where you're heading with this, I'm going to say poo.
Yes, kids love poo, and these are the best ones to bring out. If you're ever taking kids somewhere and you want to tell them about the weird stuff that people did in the past, this is a great place to start. And my first one that we're going to do is the groom of the stool. Now, this sounds glamorous and glorious and lovely. And in fact, the title is officially the groom of the king's close stool. Now,
Oh,
I don't
that's
think that means
very interesting.
close in terms of being physically close to something. It's more they used to call the loo, the kind of the close room, because it was closed essentially. So that's what it's about. Now, this is somebody that this would usually be a male member of the court, and presided over royal excretion, I'm going to say.
Okay, very nice of her.
And this is now this you might think this is horrible. This is not a thing I want to do. This was a very prestigious role, and they would help the king to go to the toilet. They would wipe his bum for him. And I think as well, if you think back to the sort of things that particularly like the Tudors are eating, they're eating the king is eating a lot of meat, a bit of veg, but not much in the way of, stuff that's gonna help things along a little bit. So there's probably gonna be quite a bit of bear down, my liege, and all this kind of stuff. Exactly. Thanks for the sound effects, Fiona. So this in kind of early modern England, this post was considered really, really an esteemed position, really important. And if you think about it, if you could potentially be in the loo for quite some time with the king, it's going to allow you unobstructed access to the attention of the king. So you can be there, you have his ear, you can have a chat to him. If there's anything that you might want to get him to do while you're there with him, be like, hey, Kingy, what do you think about this? Or oh, actually, I've heard that so and so's really good at something, so do you want to maybe make him a lord or a baron or something? So they've really got the opportunity to try and influence the king. And often these roles would be given to sons of noblemen or important members of the court or the gentry, because and it was a really sought after position. Because they had chatted to the king so much, they often had quite a lot of secrets that the king might have divulged. So they are a useful person to keep at court, and they're a useful person for other people to make friends with, because who knows when they potentially might be a little bit more loose-lipped and you can find out some secrets about it. And sometimes they would even kind of get the king's hand-me-down clothes or a variety of duties that would be bestowed upon them for their very kind of privileged position. The king trusted them, and if you sort of tell somebody something and it doesn't get around, you're like, oh, they're trustworthy, I might give them more stuff to do. So being the king's pooper scooper is actually
Goes well,
quite a
but
jammy role.
And I think wasn't that on the Who Do You Think You Are program when they go back through people's family trees? Josh Widdicombe recently turned out one of his family was groom of the stool to somebody. I can't remember which king now, but he so they
He was
talked about
very
it
well linked, wasn't he, Josh Widdicombe?
very well, and then it turned out actually much better linked further back as well. But that was the first kind of royal link that he discovered.
Which is
Yeah, I remember
quite funny.
him being quite excited.
Is it quite funny if you go back all the way to the top and you're like, oh, yes, I'm descended from
Oh.
kings. And gradually his line, going back is quite exciting, but coming down, you're like, oh, the line's gone so far
Oh.
away that all they can do is become the pooper scooper to the king in the
Yeah.
end.
Yeah. I'm just wondering about, because if you go to visit Hampton Court, whatever, they have a stool, the close stool set up that the royals used, and they were quite plush. There's velvet involved around the seat, and so actually you do want also someone who's quite meticulous and is gonna keep the whole thing nice and clean and whatever for you if you're the royal, I'm reckoning.
Well, now I think the role of keeping everything clean and emptying stuff is not the role of the groom of the stool. That is the role of the necessary woman. Which is a fantastic word, just the necessary woman. Also, I love, if you've ever been to Hampton Court Palace, especially with a guide who will gleefully show you where the building used to be that was known as the House of Easement.
Yes.
And that was the toilet. And I just love that as a House of Easement. So if any of you are, you know, I know some people like to put signs on toilet doors, get one that says House of Easement. Just, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, the necessary woman, she'd be the person who dealt with the emptying of chamber pots, and in the case of the king's necessary woman, the pay would be pretty good. It would be very, very nice, sometimes up to £60 a year. Ooh. Which is a huge amount, with additional bonus for lodgings and supplies. And also, again, that necessary woman is going to be quite a valued post, because she's going to be checking that the king is healthy, you know. She's going to know what's going on. If there's stuff happening inside, she's going to know about it.
So and always a woman,
I understand it. Yes.
Yes.
I'm sure there were exceptions to that rule throughout time, but for the most part, it seems to be a necessary woman. Because let's face it,
there's no necessary men.
That's not quite where I was going. I was going more along the lines of the women picking up all the crap behind. But anyway. Oh, hooray! So that was a necessary woman. But what happened to let's face it, the poo of all the normal people? Now, this is a job that really is not something that somebody would want to do. And in fact, this is people who were almost slightly kind of outcast from their society. These are the gong farmers. Now, from the name of gong farmer, you would assume they're going into the fields and picking gongs that are growing
nice gongs.
Which is a wonderful sort of Monty Python style view, isn't it, of gongs in a field. But a gong farmer, it was a term that was used predominantly in Tudor England, but also, you know, other periods as well, from a person who would remove the human excrement from privies and from cesspits. Gong is another word for dung.
Okay.
Simply. Yeah. They were only allowed to work at night. Uh-huh. And the waste that they...
Hence also night soil men.
Yes, that's exactly the same people. But yes. I was literally about to say the waste was called night soil.
There you go.
So night soil men, same thing. And what they would do is they would dig it all up, they'd take it out, and it had to be taken beyond the city boundaries, where I guess it just became somebody else's problem. And then this is a role that eventually disappeared as you get toilets, you know, flushing toilets that start to come in. Of course, that's less needed. But a latrine or a privy, or just the sort of local kind of dumping ground, literally, was the toilet of the Middle Ages. And so they would dig them up, they would empty everything, and they were only allowed to work between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. and they could only live in certain areas as well. for fairly obvious reasons. It was quite dangerous.
Commute to work, because presumably they worked everywhere around the city.
Yeah.
But then just lived in a certain place.
I guess so. Whether or not they had certain, you know, this is my patch, that's your patch, I don't know. Bob, there might have been a little bit of territorial nature about it. Who knows? But it was quite a dangerous job. I mean, not only are you working at night when, of course, there's no lights, you know, the same way that we have now. Absolutely. But let's face it, poo gives off fumes. And there were reports of farmers dying of asphyxiation. And I wouldn't be surprised as well if you imagine that the way that they're going to be lighting things is with a flaming torch.
Yeah.
A little bit of woof of, you know, methane going up. The poor gong farmers.
Oh.
Very, very necessary, but kind
very
of
necessary.
Dangerous and ousted as well.
So yes.
Not the one you want.
And that's a tangent. Let's not go
on. I love a tangent.
Well, no, I was just thinking two separate things. One is, Dick Whittington, Richard Whittington, the most famous Lord Mayor of the city. Thrice Lord Mayor. He founded a college and a library and blah, blah, blah. But the thing we love to talk about most is that he paid for a big public loo down by the Thames. Mm. So that was by the Thames. The idea was there. Presumably, I mean, it was like a bench with holes in it, pretty much above the water, so straight into the Thames. And of course, when you get rid of the gong farmers, it's because you've got better flushing toilets, which just meant it all just went into the Thames.
Yes.
So, you know, that wasn't necessarily an improvement.
No, it was just a relocation of the issue.
Until we get Bazalgette sorting it all out further down the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's probably where we're going to leave poo, but we do have a whole variety of other random jobs, and one that I found out about a few years ago, which honestly makes me laugh a hell of a lot. But it's not like it's not a nice job, but it's just the absolute epitome of privilege. And this is a whipping boy.
Right,
Now,
which
do you
is
know
the
what?
phrase I know,
Okay, what's the phrase? What,
but
just
well,
you
just
know
a
the.
whipping boy is like, they're like the scapegoat for something, aren't they?
Exactly. And this is what would happen. So, a whipping boy, very simple. It's so if you need to discipline a young prince, let's say someone who's going to go on to be king, you as say a teacher, governor, whatever it might be, governess, you know, whoever might be doing the teaching, whatever, if he misbehaves, he is a prince and a future king. You cannot beat him. That is not allowed. So what do? Give him a friend to play with and learn with. Who was basically becomes their best buddy. And whenever the prince messes up, you beat the other kids. This is called the whipping boy. Very, very healthy behavior. And so what you end up having is these young princes who grow up with their best mate who can misbehave all they like, and their buddy will get the punishment. And I suppose the theory is that you're such good friends with them, you don't want to see them beaten. However, given the, you know, the form of some of our kings in the past not being the nicest of guys, I can't imagine that always happened. But sometimes it came with some pretty sweet perks. Charles the First, now of course, anyone who's connected with Charles the First probably isn't going to come out of anything too well. However, while he was still king before the unfortunate de-heading, his whipping boy, he was a you know stayed faithful to him his whole life, and he elevated him to the title of Earl of Dysart. In 1643, so didn't have it for very long, but you know, hey. And so this was kind of established in the 1600s, and if the prince misbehaves or falls behind in his schooling or whatever, it's the whipping boy that gets the punishment. And this is all due to this divine right of kings. They're at the top, they're appointed by God, so nobody is worthy of punishing the king's son except, you know, either the king himself or that was a very hands
God.
off, or God, very hands off, you know, approach to parenting because that didn't really happen. And whipping boys, you might think that it would be, you know, a local little kind of peasant boy and they don't really care about him, but actually, no. Whipping boys often came from close personal allies of the royal family, children of high birth, and they were educated and grew up with the prince. They'd be of a similar age, and yeah, you get this sort of strong emotional bond. Well, that's the theory. So, in theory, you kind of are able
I
to,
mean, if you have that whole idea about hierarchical society and the king is at the top and you can't touch him, you can't have some random like lowly kid from the
No.
village. That wouldn't work, would it? It's got to be someone of almost the same status.
No, you can't have Jeff the
So,
gong farmer's son. That's not going to
oh
happen.
no, no,
No,
not
absolutely not. And you know, I'm sure everyone's pretty aware that kids used to do some pretty awful jobs. And we, of course, there's things like chimney sweeps and stuff that we know all
Yeah.
about them. But there's another one that young boys used to do, which has the fantastic name of powder monkey. You know what a powder monkey is?
Oh, I no,
So
I
much
don't.
fun. So, well, it's pretty awful, actually. The job, again, like all these jobs they give to kids, it's the ones that either the adults can't do because they're too big for them. They can't fit into the spaces the boys need to go. So they're often quite dangerous. Or the stuff they don't want to do. So they pass it to the kids and they're like, well, cannon fodder. In this case, literally cannon fodder. So if you were a young boy on a warship back in, you know, the days of endless seafaring and wars at sea and stuff, you would be called upon to stuff gunpowder into the cannons because your hands were smaller, so you could get down that barrel of the cannon. And usually they would be manning. I mean, these kids could be anywhere from sort of 10 to 14 years of age, possibly even younger, potentially. I mean, in theory, the limit was sort of 10 to 14, but well, you know, these things go a bit wonky at times. And they would n man the artillery guns, the naval guns, as part of a warship's crew, so an actual part of the crew. And the main role was to bring gunpowder from the magazine into the ship's hold, to the guns, to the cannons, either in bulk, so you know, just sort of powder there, then stuff, or in cartridges. And the aim is to kind of minimize the risk of fire and explosions, but guess what? You know, if that does happen, who's at the front line of that? Well, this poor little powder monkey. They usually like I say, sort of 10 to 14 years of age, they're selected for their speed and their height. So they had to be quite short, and they had to be able to kind of whip in and out of all the quite, you know, sort of small, dark little areas between the decks. And some of these decks, you know, they're not full height. So for the adults going down there, it wouldn't be super handy. So the kids, yeah, shove them in there. They would be hidden behind the ship's gunwales, so on the sides, and that which would protect them from being shot by enemy sort of sharpshooters, because the sharpshooters are going to be on the ships going, take out the powder monkeys, and they can't stuff the guns. They didn't have a naval rank, and you could sometimes get some women as well, and occasionally some older men who would work as powder monkeys too, but it was predominantly kids. And of course, this is where we do get the poorer working class kids. Of course, you're not going to get your earls and your lords there.
No.
And the way they recruited them was to say, look, we will give you clothing, bedding, we'll give you a bit of education, nothing major, you know, but a bit. And they reckon that in the 1790s, the Marine Society was sending 500 to 600 boys a year out to the fleet. Now, not all of them would become powder monkeys, but the younger ones almost certainly would. And if you think these boys are being recruited, they've got no other option, because the parents often can't afford to raise them. A lot of the fact they would have of them would have family ties to the sea as well. You know, being a sailor was something that a lot of people did, because it got you out of poverty. Well, it got you accommodation, food, all that sort of stuff. So a lot of people did, plus people were shanghaied and all this kind of thing. And so if you've got your entire family, your parents, grandparents, whatever, who are in the Navy, who are sailors, it's going to make you want to kind of carry that on. So that's what they were trying to impress upon.
The Marine Society, wasn't that was orphans as well sometimes, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
They sort of describe it as teaching people a trade, you know, sending them to seeing, getting them a trade and things, but it's a pretty rough start.
And a very dangerous one. I mean, the number of sailors who came back with missing limbs or missing eyes or, you know, disfigurements or life-changing injuries, because, you know, you fall from the rigging and take your ankle off, whatever. So, yeah, it is teaching them a trade. It is also giving them food, board, lodging, a bit of money as well. But you're right, it's cannon fodder a lot of the time. And with the orphans, the bonus of that is that they don't have to ask any parents for any permission. So yeah, you're right, they did, which is pretty awful, but you know, that's how it worked. Now I want to go slightly into a couple of health ones and sort of weird things that people used to do. So we talked about the groom of the stool who would, you know, help the king on the loo, but you've got somebody else who is going to help the king and rich people generally to get your hot water for washing yourself, clothes, whatever. And these are lower rank people. These are medieval labourers. They're called ewerers. Now, a ewer is kind of like a fancy jug, you know, the sort of the jug and basin you'd have for washing in a room. And they are responsible for bringing in the hot water for the nobles and taking water to the guests at the table for washing of hands as well. And also, when it comes to the king, he'd be responsible for drying the king's clothes if they got wet, you know, if they were hunting or travelling or whatever, and for the king's bath. But they got paid extra for when the king had a bath. 4 pence every time.
Ooh. Yes. Well, that immediately makes me think that might... Well, Elizabeth I, didn't she say, I have a bath every 6 months, whether I need it or not?
Something like that, yeah.
So her ewer wasn't making a lot of extra cash.
And on top of that, the ewers, if the king bathed at Easter, Whitsun or Christmas, then the king was bathed for free. He didn't get that.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they got paid double.
No, of course not. Because, of course, don't forget, the king has come from God. Therefore, it's a religious festival. You are just doing God's work.
Holy days. Obviously.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So you don't get paid for bringing the water, for running the king's bath. But, I mean, what a job. Just a water, you know.
Yeah. It kind of just makes you realise how many servants there were in the household that people were doing something that was so specific.
Yes.
That was their entire... Yeah. Maybe they did other things as well, but, you know, that is a named role is
And there's still now, isn't there, a chap who works at, well, there's one at each of the palaces, which who is the flag man.
Oh, yes. Who runs up the flag when people come and go. I mean, yeah, not runs up the flag.
I'm doing runs the flag up.
That Alex can see, but the people listening
it's
at
a
home.
A very rude say, gesture.
It's not. It's not. I was miming pulling a string.
Is that what it was? Okay, cool.
Yeah, pulling a string. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if the flag man does anything else. I mean, he must do, but well, I know it's just one person whose job it is.
They get accommodation at Windsor, don't they? Because there's a specific house that the flagman lives in.
Yeah. Now, is it flagman or flagman? Like Batman or Batman?
But flag person in this day and age.
Well, no, because it's always a man.
Flag person.
Because it's one person. But yeah, anyway, random things.
And flag kind of. I'm going to.
Yeah, let's go with that. Right Honourable Flagster in Chief. Anyway.
Flagster is better, yeah.
Carrying on with kind of health, and I know this is one that you particularly like, which is about the barbers. Now, of course, a barber, we know what a barber is. However, barbers weren't always just barbers, you know, going in for a short back and sides and whatever. They were barber surgeons. Now, if you wanted, well, pretty much anything doing that involved some kind of surgery, you didn't go to the doctor for that. No, you went to the barber surgeon and he would remove lice, trim hair, shave beards, remove teeth, bloodlet, remove bullets. And if you ever see one of the classic old barbers, now they don't always have them. It's usually a sign of somebody who still uses the kind of the open cutthroat razor to shave. You get those white and red, sometimes white, red and blue poles, and sometimes they're spinning out the front. And this is one of the last kind of vestiges of the medical profession part of that job. Of course, you don't do it anymore. Now, there's a few theories about what it means, and I'm sure you have a theory as well, Fiona. What I was always told is that the brass tip represents the basin that collects the patient's blood, mm-hmm. and the white and the red sort of intertwine and kind of like almost like a helix represent the blood and bandages.
Yeah, blood and bandages. I've heard that.
Yeah, there's another one, a theory that it represents the patient's bloody fingers gripping onto a stick for pain relief. I don't know if there's any truth in that. I feel like it's more the blood and bandages thing.
Yeah,
and you know lower classes couldn't afford a physician.
Oh. And did so they? There was something about some people say that they, you know, they had to wash the bandages and then they'd hang them out to dry, so the bandages would be hanging outside the shop, and then maybe like that's why it sort of hangs outside the door.
Interesting. I didn't know that one. I'm going to steal that and not credit you.
Fair enough.
I mean, if you're a king or a noble or whatever, you've got the money to have a physician, and these guys will be, often a lot of the time, kind of quacks because they didn't really know what they were doing. And sometimes they would intervene surgically in ways that would not improve matters. In fact, would sometimes very much decrease the odds of your survival to next to zero. So if you are a bog standard, you know, gong farmer or whoever you might be, you would go to one of these barber surgeons. And of course, you've got a lot of people working in jobs that would bring up illnesses and injuries really regularly. You're thinking soldiers, you know, all you need to do is put a fork through your foot in the field, or get kicked in the face by a cow or something. You've got you've got soldiers, you've got workers of all kinds who are going to be getting all kinds of afflictions and lacerations and this, that and the other, much more than the nobles. So nobles are fine, really. And the physicians didn't really want to then get their hands dirty to kind of come and minister to the scum and kind of deal with their muddy wounds and all that kind of thing. So this is where the barber surgeons would be like, yeah, come on, I'll do it. And that's how it all sort of developed. They did have to apply to the trade guild and therefore would become apprentices to barbers. So that, you know, there was an element of sort of governance, I guess. I mean, of course, healthcare not being what it is now. They would do a lot of, let's say, kind of in bracket or in quotation marks, healing tasks that physicians wouldn't do. So they would stitch up wounds and lacerations. They would treat burns, rashes. They would set broken bones and dislocated limbs. Mm-hmm. They would even deal with venereal diseases. They would lance infections and boils. They'd kind of apply all kinds of lotions and potions. And some of the more skilled ones would do things like amputation, cauterization, trepanation, which is the making of a hole in the head to relieve pressure and all that kind of thing, and even delivering babies on occasions too. And so the barber surgeon sort of became a lowlier form of a, say, a true surgeon, really. They were given more basic procedures to do, and they would they would assist with bloodletting and cupping and pulling teeth and all this sort of stuff. And eventually, as the as time progressed, the barber surgeons, who were the apprentices to the barbers, became more and more independent, and eventually went on to become kind of competition for proper surgeons. But I mean, it's quite, if you can imagine, just going, I'm just going to go for a cheeky beard trim, and next year is someone who's screaming in agony as a bullet is dug out of their shoulder or something. I mean, it's a pretty hideous thing to have to deal with, really.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good. And there's always that sort of odd divide. So in the City of London, all these different trade guilds, there's the Barber Surgeons Company, and then there's also the Apothecaries.
Mm.
And they sound like they're chemists, but they were given the right to prescribe and dispense medicine at some point. Mm. So they actually nowadays have lots of general practitioners. Your local GP might well be a member of the Apothecaries. So that, yeah, it's quite confusing who does what in medical things in the past, because it mixes up all over the place. The Apothecaries started the Chelsea Physic Garden.
Yes, and we have done an episode on that a long, long time ago.
Yeah. But I was... This partly sprang to mind because of this Tudor thing I'm doing tomorrow, and I was looking up. So there was the beginning of surgery... You only want to have an operation if you really have to, because it's so risky. So the main start surgery people did early on was amputations, because if, you know, it's going to go rotten, you're going to die anyway, you might as well try and cut it off and hope for the best.
Yeah.
And there was a surgeon called William Close, who worked at Bart's Hospital in the city, who he served with both the Army and the Navy before he went to Bart's. And people said, well, that gave him unparalleled experience with guns, swords, syphilis, and scurvy.
I love the little chucking of syphilis in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And he said a surgeon should have a lion's heart, a lady's hand, and a hawk's eye.
Ooh.
Which I think is quite a nice combination.
That is.
And if you're doing amputations without either anaesthetic or what's the other one? Antiseptic, but particularly no anaesthetic. The main thing you want to do is be fast.
Yeah.
So in a morning's work at Bart's Hospital was 7 arms and legs was his tally in a morning, was a good morning's work for him.
Which... And we talked about the necessity for speed when we did our episode on the old operating theatre. Again, we talked about the guy who, I can't remember his name now, who essentially was the sort of world record for amputations, because he was, but you know, like you say, it's a last chance saloon type thing. It's, you're going to die anyway, so shall we give it a shot? Because, yeah.
Why not?
Might as well.
Yeah.
So there we go. So now, if you think about other, you said it's, there's a whole heap of people that do different stuff in medicinal history, and we don't, all sorts of people do different stuff. There's another really random job, which links in to health, and this is a leech collector.
Oh, okay.
Now, of course, for, I think this is one of the most wonderful things, because often we hear about, oh, you know, people used to have leeches applied, and still do, actually. There's still,
Yeah,
and they're quite good for removing dead flesh and things, aren't they?
Exactly, maggots.
They were maggots,
just talking the other day about how maggot therapy is used so much less than it ought to be, because they're really, really good at getting rid of infections and
And the leeches, it's not dead flesh. I'm thinking it's about getting blood flow into an area that is struggling with blood flow, isn't it? So like a new wound or something.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
But what you never think about is, where do the leeches come from? Now, of course, now it's going to be very different. They'll be bred for them, whatever. But back in the day, if you needed leeches, you had to get them. And so leech collectors would, what they would do is they would take out into the marshes and wherever there would be lots of leeches with a sort of severed animal leg. shove it into the ground or shove it into the marsh or whatever, and wait for the leeches to be like, oh, and up they come, start to, you know, having a nice little snack, and then you whip it out the ground and you take them in and you take the leeches off and sell them to doctors who will then use them to treat people. And that this the use of leeches really peaked between the sort of early 1800s, kind of early 1830s to 1850s.
Okay, yeah.
It was quite a sort of steep period of, yay, leeches, and then it kind of fell off a lot. And during this, what was known as the leech craze, leech collectors, who were often women, actually, would wade into ponds with their skirts raised to attract the leeches to themselves, like stuffing the animal, you know, get the animal leg out of the way. They'd also take, if you had like an old limpy horse that was too old to work anymore, again, you walk it into the marsh and let the leeches get onto the legs, then you could take it off from there. But now, this isn't particularly hard work in terms of physical work, but what it is quite dangerous, because they often caught infections from the leeches and suffered from blood loss.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
if you're, yes.
It's fantastic. Oh. It's absolutely brilliant. I love it.
Did you ever have one of those things where you put your feet in a fish tank?
I
did it once. And like you said, it was kind of like, it seemed to be a thing for a bit. And then now they've gone again, haven't they? Yeah. Nobody's still doing that.
And there was all sorts of issues with them not being healthy, because basically all they were being fed on was human flesh.
Human fish. Yeah.
It's not ideal, is it, really? Nah. I always meant to do it, but I never quite got around to it, which is probably a good thing, to be fair. I want to go for a couple of jobs that have the utterly mad names. Now, there's one name I'm going to come to which people might be a little bit more familiar with in a moment, but I want to start with one called a knock-knobbler.
Ooh.
Yes, a knock-knobbler. You have to be very careful when you say that, actually.
Yeah.
You know what a knock-knobbler did?
I don't know.
Would you imagine from the name a knock-knobbler does?
Oh, okay. So,
let's test her.
Is there some sort of banging noise, like knocking, making a noise?
Sort of, possibly.
To stop something happening?
Yes.
To nobble?
Kind of.
Restrict something?
Yeah.
What would that be?
I'm going to put you out of your misery.
Yeah, please.
Their job was to chase out unruly dogs from a church during services. Which is utterly mad. Yeah. And they have been...
That's
because
you didn't wait for me to guess that.
I actually might have just committed to see how long it would take you to get there. But there are actually records of payment in parish books for dog whippers and knock-knobblers. I did say that right, didn't I? Yes, I did. Thank goodness. So you can see in certain parish accounts that they paid for these people to be there. And what would happen is people would come into the church service and their dogs would accompany them, or possibly even stray dogs if they thought, oh, loads of people, I'm going to get some food. Yeah. And if they started to become a bit disruptive, they started barking or having a go at each other or whatever, the dog whipper would remove them from the church and allow the service to carry on. They were given a whip, hence the name, the dog whipper, and... Uh-huh. Often, now this is my favourite thing, they were given a large pair of wooden tongs. So you can just sort of like, I don't know, like chopstick your dogs out, you know? Yeah, I guess so. And they were paid for this. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. There's another name, and this, we're going slightly back, we probably should have done this a bit earlier, going back to someone who deals a little bit with poo, and this is a tosher.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure you know toshers, don't you?
Toshers, I think, yes. Although I might struggle to define exactly what they did. But yeah, something to do with poo, definitely. And
yeah, sewers. Well, they would scavenge in the sewers, particularly during Victorian periods when the sewers kind of really grew up. And it wasn't uncommon for you to see an entire family disappearing off into the sewers. Of course, again, a bit like your gong farmer, they're not particularly popular with their nearest and dearest. Because they're a little bit stinky. But they would essentially be going through the sewers trying to find treasure. And often, you know, this is the Victorian era and all sorts of dodgy stuff's happening. They'd often be sifting through dead bodies to find stuff and things that they could sell. And again, it's dangerous because if it's raining and the sewers fill up, you're going to get, you know, going to drown or again, asphyxiation, all this sort of thing as well. I mean, just honestly, some of the... Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was going to say we kind of still have an equivalent of that, but that's not quite true. But we still have people who work in the sewers to, you know, when they get blocked and those kind of things. Mm. There's still people who work in the sewers, but
yeah, but they're not going down there to find treasure hunting.
Not on a freelance basis.
Not on a freelance basis. No. Now, the last one I want to talk about tonight is, again, I think this is one that people might know a little bit about, but it's another fantastically brilliant word. It's knocker-uppers.
Uh-huh.
And now this is something that goes down in it's quite famous. So this is a job that existed when people needed to get up for work before alarm clocks. And what they uh-huh. would do is they would hire a knocker-upper to either come and tap on your window, either if ground level, you know, with your hand, if it's above ground with a big stick, or some would spit peas at your window at an appointed time, and you would pay them to do this. And this went on until the 1970s.
Wow.
I know, it's amazing. So it often happened in, particularly, especially after the Industrial Revolution, in northern towns where people worked shifts, or in London, in the docks, where people would, you know, be all sorts of really random hours. And what they would do is they would come past at a particular time. You would pay to be woken up at, let's say, 5:30. You'd only get a few taps and that was it. If you didn't wake up, yeah. Tough. That, you know, they're not gonna stand there for hours and be like, Dave, you up, Dave. And it must have been pretty effective because, you know.
Yeah.
And what knocker-uppers would do is they would sleep in the day and wake up about 4 p.m. And then they would stay awake through the night to wake up the shift workers at night. And the way that it started is originally they used to knock at doors and ring doorbells, but yeah. It ended up annoying so many people. Everyone else was like, I don't want to get up. Why are you making so much noise?
Because there must have been lots of houses with like multiple occupancy as well.
Yes, absolutely.
They can't just ring the front doorbell because that'll annoy everyone else.
And also the people who are paying for it, Sometimes they'd be waking up other people who hadn't paid for it. So they're like, well, I'm paying for it. Why is Jeff down the way not paying for it, but he's getting up at the same time as me and he's hearing you knock? So they ended up being, you know, very much more specific. And that's my window. You tap on that window, you wake me up, that kind of thing.
Yeah. When when they've been asleep during the day, the knocker-uppers, do they employ a knocker-upper to come and knock them up to start their shift?
They do. Hey. It's known as the knocker-upper's knocker-upper.
Hey.
And how much that goes into a cyclical thing, I don't know. There might be the knocker-uppers knocker-upper and onward into silliness. But yeah, so they did. They would have their own knocker-upper who'd come and knock them up.
And there
was one who became very well known, a lady called Mary Smith, and you can find pictures of her online. She worked in the East End of London. She used a pea shooter. She looked like quite a formidable woman. If you see pictures of her, she's...
Yeah, I've seen...
Yeah. She's amazing. And she would charge sixpence a week to wake her clients up. And her daughter, Mary, also went into the same trade. There was a lady called Mrs. Bowers in County Durham. And the last knocker-upper in Poole, who worked until about 1918, was a lady called Granny Cousins. So, again, a job for women.
Yeah.
And quite an important one, because it would mean that the menfolk were getting up and going to their shifts at the factories. And
absolutely.
Bringing in the bacon.
And presumably you had regular clients, so you'd probably have a sort of routine. I was just thinking, when you said like factory shift work, you can't be doing everyone at the same time. You must have to say to them, well, like, I can't do you at 5 to 7, but I can do you at 5 past.
Yeah, I guess so.
Or
yeah.
Whatever. And they must
have, I suppose you'd have a patch. Yeah. And you'd kind of, you know, say, I'll be, but I suppose if you're only knocking a couple of times, you can get through quite a lot of people quite quickly.
That's true. Quite a lot of peas as well.
Quite a lot of peas. Yeah, she must have been a fortune.
Is there someone else following her around, picking up the peas? Pea picker-upper.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah, the knocker-upper's pea picker-upper.
Exactly that.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Now, I must admit, when you said knocker-upper, I thought of a different job.
Oh.
Because if you... if you're a woman who gets sent to Newgate and arrested for something and you're due to be executed and hanged, I mean, you can't hang a pregnant woman, can you? No. So if you're in Newgate jail, not pregnant, there were gentlemen who provided a service to enable you to be pregnant. And I don't know, it'd be fascinating to know the records, like, presumably this...
I'm just really enjoying the phrase, gentleman who provided a service to enable you to be pregnant. That's one of the best things I've ever heard.
But it's kind of like, presumably this is just a temporary reprieve, because what
you
happens
would think.
Next? And so what I would love to know is whether by the time they've given birth, somehow they get reprieved through some other reason, or they now have to look after their child so they don't get executed, or how, you know, it seems. Yeah, but of the various people hanging around prisons providing services.
I've never heard of that one. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And they were called knocker-uppers as well.
I don't know, but that's the natural name to call them, surely.
Gosh, you'd want to employ the right one, wouldn't you? Yeah. Be a bit of a shock if at 4 a.m. in the East End someone else comes into your room and, you know, rather than tapping on your window, you get a very different surprise.
Yeah, don't mix up your knocker-uppers.
No. That's amazing. Have you got any other crazy jobs that you know about?
Maybe not quite as crazy, but actually knocker-uppers sort of ties in with this as well. And I'm intrigued that you said one of them was like a family business. Because whenever I'm in Greenwich, I love the Belleville family, who had a pocket watch called Arnold. And every morning, Henry started this off. And then I think his wife... and then their daughter. So yeah, the wife was called Maria, and then the daughter Ruth. So from the 1836 onwards,
I know about
the
these people.
Family would go and collect the time from the Royal Observatory in Greenwich each morning with Arnold, and then walk down to the City of London and sell the time.
Yeah,
the correct time to businesses. And like you said, the knocker-upper still 1970. Ruth was doing it until 1940.
Amazing.
And it just is such an astonishing thing that the correct time was still a viable commodity to sell in 1940.
Well, I suppose it's because watches and clocks were wind up, weren't they? So if you haven't wound it at the right time, it's going to have lost time, and
they
you
might
could
not
be
run
running late. Exactly.
And,
so if you know that Ruth's popped down there that morning and she's got the exact Greenwich time, and you can be like, oh, flipping heck, my watch was 10 minutes late.
Yeah.
You know.
And you can stand, if you stand at the bottom of the hill in Greenwich, you can see St Alfred's Church with a clock on it and Greenwich Town Hall with a clock on it.
Yeah.
And the reason why they put clocks on town halls was because that was the clock that everyone could see and could read. And, you know, nowadays we have a clock on our wrist, on our phone, on our oven, on, like, we're surrounded with clocks, which are generally pretty accurate.
Yeah.
But the whole notion that, and also, like, you tell a youngster that you used to ring up a phone line to find out the time.
Oh, I know, the talking clock.
Yeah. And it's a whole mad thing about the accuracy of time, which time is a pure kind of construct anyway.
Yeah. Oh, it's getting very deep.
Yeah.
Time is a construct. Join us next week for a philosophical discussion on whether time is a construct. Oh, amazing. Yeah, and I've forgotten about the time sellers, the Belleville family.
Time lady. I think Ruth did it for longest, so she was known as the time lady.
Amazing. That's so fantastic. Oh, well, thank you so much for joining me this week, Fiona. What a treat to have you back.
I wish it was for a better reason, but
yes.
I'm delighted to come back. It's always a joy.
And we will have you back again, I am sure. And Carmen is okay. She's out there out of hospital, but it's just, you know... hopefully Emily will be back with us next week. We're sending Emily all of our love and hugs.
Lots
and squishes
of love
to Carmen. But there we go. So there won't be a poll this week on Podcast Pedestal, unless you particularly want one, Fiona.
I mean, surely you could get people to just vote for their favourite job in a sort of, not in a binary way. You know, people could just pitch in with which of these.
I like it. All right, we'll do that then. We'll put that up as what's your favourite random job, weirdest jobs in history, or do you know of another one that we've not mentioned? Let us know. And we can add it into next week's one. But that's it for this week. Thank you all so much for coming. We really appreciate it. Fiona, is there anything that you're up to that you'd like to tell everyone about?
No. I'm going away for a week. Yay!
Fabulous. Tell everyone where you're going and then they can come and bug you.
I'm going to the Canaries.
Very nice.
Enjoy a bit of nice warm sunshine.
So everyone, over to the Canaries and start asking Fiona about tube stops
and
when you're sitting by the pool.
Could knock me up at 8:15 each morning, obviously.
Which version, though?
I couldn't possibly say.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being here, and we will see you again. And we will see you all next week, gang, for hopefully service as usual. But have a wonderful week, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.